Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namāsāmi. Today is the new moon day, and also the 4th of July. Not a big holiday in Britain, but in the USA, this is one of the big festivals of the year. And as people probably are mostly aware, it's the what's being celebrated on the 4th of July is independence of the American people from the tyranny of the British. So free from being under the thumb of the British Crown, the Americans celebrate this day when they made their declaration of independence. They didn't actually get to be independent, even politically, for quite a few years, until quite a few years later, I think 10 or 12 years afterwards, but they declared it on July the 4th, 1776. So that's a bit of a problem for me because I have two nationalities. I have a British passport and an American passport. So on this day, I my American part celebrates its freedom from my British part. Actually, it's not that much of a problem, but if you think about it. So that that kind of celebration of independence, you can understand that on a social level, and the sense of freedom, or say the lack of being dominated by another power, is something significant. It's a big national holiday for more than 200 years now in the USA. But it's also since we're Dhamma practitioners, and this is a Buddhist monastery, and our work is to reflect upon things according to the Buddha's perspective, and use the Buddha's teachings to look at our experience of life, then it's always a day, at least when I was living in the USA up until 6 years ago, that you would consider, well, what is independence? How do we truly live in a way that is free of dependencies? How do we do that? Because a country can declare independence, a few British politicians were declaring independence on June the 24th, or that they were saying that June the 23rd would be remembered as the Independence Day of the United Kingdom. But it's helpful to consider what is genuine independence. How can we truly be free? And when we look at it, we see that a country can say pass its own laws, or it can say separate out from the rulership of a dominant power like the USA, freeing itself from the rulership of the British. But I've lived in America for 15 or 20 years, and it's very much the case that people there are not free. It's called, even on the stamps, it says, land of the brave and home of the free. But the experience of living there is a lot of lack of freedom, particularly if you're not white, not male, not of owning classes. If you're African American, Mexican, Native American, Asian, if you are a woman, if you are poor, then there's a lot of limitations on your freedom, and in many and various ways. So the principle is there of being free, but the actuality of the society, and also just in the attitudes that people have, are like everywhere else. There's a lot of limitation, a lot of dependencies that the mind is subject to. That there's a lack of freedom in many and various ways. From the Buddhist perspective, the goal is freedom as well, to the quality of liberation, vimutti, also called nisarana, the escape from the bonds of birth, aging and death, escaping from the round of rebirth, the bhava chakra. That is the goal, independence. But it's not from the dominance by a particular government or a particular ruler or a particular social class. It's not like the sudras and the chandalas, Dalit people escaping from the dominance by the Brahmins and the warrior nobles. But rather, the tyranny that the teachings point to is the tyranny of greed, hatred, and delusion. The word tyranny, or its partner tyrant, we use it in a way in English. It's used as a kind of oppressive domination, is what it means. A tyrant is a kind of heartless dictator who just controls the lives of others completely. But the word comes from the Greek tyrannos, which just means a king. This means that's the individual who's at the top of the pile. The tyrannos is the king. And so in the Buddhist perspective, the tyranny that we are freeing ourselves from is when greed, hatred, and delusion are given absolute power in our minds. That's what we are freeing ourselves from. And so rather than taking a political approach or a social approach, the Buddha chose a psychological approach, that freedom is something that we can obtain, that's something we can realize within ourselves. The body is necessarily limited. It's subject to the laws of nature. We have to breathe, we have to eat, we have to keep away things that are going to give us diseases or going to harm us. The body is limited, it's dependent. In living in society, living with other people, living in a human group, in a village or in a family, in a monastery, in a country, there are thousands and thousands of different limitations, laws and customs and standards that we need to keep as human beings to live harmoniously with others. So in terms of freedom, the complete freedom of the heart, the freedom of dependence, freedom from dependence of any kind, that the quality of being unlimited, being able to be, unbounded, is found within the heart, is found within the mind. It's an internal freedom. And the things that are limiting the heart, the things that are causing the bondage, the things that are principally, creating that frustration or limitation, boundaries, are driven by what are called the three akusala mula, the three unwholesome roots, greed, that is called lobha in Pali, dosa, aversion, negativity, hatred, and moha, delusion. These are the three tyrants, or like they had in the ancient Rome, the triumvirate, the three rulers joined together to run Rome and the Roman Empire as a unit. The triumvirate, beings, the three people that join together. So it's a kind of unholy triumvirate, you can call it, of greed, hatred, and delusion, dosa, lobha, moha. This is the tyrannical leadership, that which is ruling our lives, ruling our hearts and minds, and which is the cause of our frustration, our limitations, our lack of freedom. So this is the Buddhist perspective, as I understand it and as I work with it. So when we recognize that that's certainly within the social world, the political world, there can be a lot of oppression and by the government treating the citizens very badly, very abusively, or your country being in a state of war, having civil war, or being attacked by outside forces, people blowing themselves up, or deliberately causing harm, bombing, attacking, sending in drones and such like. So there certainly are oppressive forces from outside, either from your own government or other people's governments or other groups. It's not to deny that there is oppression or a difficulty that comes from external forces. But if you look at it, if you consider it, well, what are the forces that are guiding the minds of those who are bombing you or who are attacking you or mistreating you? It's the greed, hatred, and delusion in the minds of the people running your government or who are attacking your society or who are causing chaos and difficulty. It's the forces of greed, hatred, and delusion in the minds of those individuals as groups as well that is causing those oppressive forces within our lives, that are causing those, experiences of fear, of distress, and stirring up anger and insecurity, and so on, within ourselves. So that whether it's within ourselves or outside ourselves, then the most important thing is to understand greed, hatred, delusion, to see these unwholesome roots, to get to know them, to understand them, to see how they work, to use the Buddha's teachings and the practice of meditation, the capacity for wise reflection, to genuinely understand how these guys get power, how they take power, and how they carry out their rulership in our minds. Yeah. What is it in us that gives greed the authority to guide our choices? What is it that gives hatred and aversion? What gives it the power to guide our lives? And delusion. Yeah. What is it within us that says to the force of moha, the force of delusion, please take charge, you drive. It's up to you. I leave it to you to make the choices. How does that happen? How do we end up handing over the authority for our lives to greed, hatred, and delusion? And how can we take back the authority? How can that tyrants, how can they be taken down? How can they be deposed or voted out of office? how can the power be taken away from greed, hatred, and delusion and be given back into the hands of mindfulness and wisdom and back into the hands of what is the wholesome and noble aspects of our being? I guess I'm thinking a lot about politics and society and such like, and chaos and confusion, oppression, particularly because of the vote for the referendum that happened in this country on June the 23rd. Since that day, it's only about 10 days ago. It's been a long 10 days, I think, for many people. Then a lot of people have been asking questions or expressing their own feelings, mostly distress and confusion and fear. Some people are extremely happy. Won't mention any names, but some people surprisingly happy, other people surprisingly distressed, and So it's a important area to consider, to think about. The vote in the referendum it's not a law. Referendum means it's a reference point. It's a Latin word, meaning it's something that the country can refer to. And so there's big discussions about whether the vote should really stand, whether it needs to be ratified by the government. If it does go through, what will it mean? What will it mean to the resident community of Amravati? I think only about 15% of us are British. The others are French, German, Korean, Thai, Slovakian, Cambodian, Japanese, American, Mexican, Italian, Swedish, French, Sri Lankan, Norwegian, German, French, German, Mexican, Portuguese, and British Singaporean. And that's just the monastics. So a few of us are British and many of us are not. So if this gets passed into law and the UK actually leaves the European Union, or parts of the UK leave the European Union, maybe Scotland will join up with Norway, maybe Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland will become an independent nation again. Maybe there'll be home rule for Essex. The kingdom will break up like it was in the Anglo-Saxon era, where we had England was seven nations. We would be Essex then. We have independent Essex. So, and across the river, the Kentish people, the people of Kent, and then you have the people of Wessex from sort of Buckinghamshire, Hertfordshire, and Hampshire, westwards in the south, that's Wessex. Mercia is the bit in the middle. And Northumberland is everything north of the Humber up to the Scottish border. And Scotland, of course, would be independent. So some of you might be thinking, don't even say that, Ajahn. You're being recorded. Don't, if you say those things out loud, it will make it much more easy to happen. But I feel it's useful to think the unthinkable and to contemplate without fear or without confusion what's the situation that we're experiencing. So it's a lot of turbulence, whether it's a good thing or it's a bad thing, whether it's a mixture of good things and bad things. What we can know is that there's turbulence and uncertainty. It's like anicca, uncertainty, with a big A, anicca. Things are very uncertain. Even in the political leadership, it's kind of interesting that so David Cameron, the Prime Minister, resigned, and so he's going to hold office for a few more months. And then a lot of the Labour Party would like Jeremy Corbyn to resign, but he's not resigning yet. Boris Johnson, who everyone thought was going to step up to put himself forward to be the next Prime Minister, having led the charge for to leave the European Union with great vigour and eloquence, he now says, well, actually, I'm not interested in leading the country to make that happen. So someone else can do that. And today, Nigel Farage stepped down as the leader of the UK Independence Party, which is another interesting move. So there seems to be a bit of a crisis of leadership, at least south of the Scottish border. Not to make this too political, but north of the Scottish border, they've got very strong leadership. Nicola Sturgeon is doing a fine job binding the Scottish people together, but could easily bind them together to leave the rest of the UK behind. So it's a time of turbulence and confusion. What's going to happen? And then for the non-monastic members of the community, what's going to happen to people's savings? What's going to happen to mobility within Europe? What's going to happen to the pension that you were so carefully putting away? Where's it going to go? What's going to happen? How's it going to be? So pretty much everywhere you look in terms of the UK situation, there's a lot of uncertainty. could be things that could turn out very good, they could turn out very bad, it could be a mixture of both. And who's going to be in charge, how they're going to be in charge, what are they going to be in charge of, is all really, really uncertain. So this is one of the reasons why politics is not a refuge. So I would say politics is not a refuge, and so that you can certainly the political world and the agreements, the laws that are put in place through the political process are significant. But I would say politics is an upaya. It's a skillful means. It's not a refuge. You're never going to find satisfaction and fulfillment through the political process. It's a skillful means that can support satisfaction, freedom, happiness, but it can't do it on its own, I would say, in my humble opinion. And on this, even though I'm talking a little bit about the political realm this evening, it was noticeable that whenever anybody asked Ajahn Chah about which political party he supported or who he thought were the best politicians, he simply said, at least as it was reported to me, so he said something along the lines of, "I never talk about politics. I only talk about things which have an end. Politics has no end, therefore I don't talk about it." So that I think is a very good standard to have. But also I think given that the situation that this country is in at the moment and the kind of distress and confusion, uncertainty that people are meeting with, it's important to not just push that away or pretend that's not happening, because these events are affecting the hearts of many people and the possibilities of where we might be able to live or what people might be able to do or what resources will be available in the future. Oh, politics is not a refuge. It's not dependable. What's the best approach, or how can we understand this or reflect on what we're experiencing? Well, it's also politics is the polis, is the people. There are aspects of people that are very much worthy of respect and are dependable. So when we chant the reflections on the Sangha refuge, the qualities of the Sangha refuge, we recite these words: the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings. These are the Blessed One's disciples. Such ones are worthy of gifts. Worthy of offerings, and so forth. That these, in terms of the of people and the human realm, the realm of people that are dependable or reliable or are a refuge, then it's that quality of awakenedness that is there in the hearts of various individuals, the wise, the awake, the noble, those who have developed spiritual maturity amongst the population. Those are the people to pay attention to. Those are the ones to follow and use the example of. So that when I say that politics is not a refuge, it doesn't mean that people are not. It doesn't mean all people are not dependable or all people are worthless. But certainly, this is the encouragement of the Buddha, is to look to the human examples of those who are wise, those who are awake, those who have let go of greed, hatred, and delusion, that these are our guides and our support, the sarana, the refuge in the world. Also, when Lumpur Sumedho would talk about the Sangha refuge, he would often stress that when we're taking refuge in Sangha, the first set of qualities that we describe in there, he says, he would say how supatipanno, ujjupatipanno, nyayapatipanno, samichipatipanno, that rather than just say those qualities in others, in those who we might look to as being wise and awakened, liberated, teachers and guides, that the refuge is to look within your heart and to look and to discover and to listen to that in your heart which practices well, supatipanno, that you're in your heart which is devoted to the good, to the noble, the good, the wholesome. Ujjupatipanno, that to listen to that in your heart which is practices directly, which takes action to be awake, to be wise in this moment, that is uju, straightforward, direct, undistorted. Nyaya patipanno, that which is insightful, to listen to that voice in your heart which is wise, which is attuned to the time, the place, the situation, which is adaptable, which learns to recognize how the world works, how our life, our body, our mind works. Nyaya patipanno, samichi patipanno. Those who are, say, practicing, say, in a way which is appropriate, taking action, speaking, say, in an appropriate, discreet way, according to what's useful, what's timely, what's going to be beneficial. And developing that to a quality of fullness and strength, strengthening those qualities. So to take refuge in people, or to see that there are worthy qualities within the population, then you are one of that population within whom there are noble qualities. So that when we are looking for guidance or for resources, we have those resources within us in the midst of turbulence, in the midst of uncertainty and activity, and the unpredictable nature of society. Then we, moment by moment, we have the capacity to practice well, to practice directly, to practice insightfully, and to be accomplished in the practice, to develop consummate skill with being awake, being mindful, being unselfish, being kind and compassionate. So those resources are within us, and so those are the most powerful and helpful resources that we have in the moment by moment meeting with turbulence, unpredictability, and the quality of distress in society, or feelings of distress and agitation that arise within our own minds, that we can practice with it. We can be awake to it. We can know it. We can be at peace with it. We don't have to run away from it. We don't have to fight against it. We don't have to crumple and fall down in a heap in the face of that uncertainty or distress or anger. Just within the last 10 days, a few people have expressed very strong feelings to me about how they're upset about how the vote went or what was going to happen, or various members of their family who think very differently and how this is being very divisive and confusing, and or people who are not British experiencing very painful and ugly criticisms and attacks by people that they work with, people who they thought they were friendly with, and their colleagues in the workplace. The sort of shock of hearing people making very derogatory, critical, negative, sort of racist or nationalist remarks. So that these are the resources that we have. We can practice. We can bring the quality of mindfulness and wisdom, wakefulness, in each moment. So that rather than trying to figure out which politician we can trust, or who's telling you the truth, who's the politician to say take refuge in? Say, well, let you be the politician that you take refuge in. You are part of the polis, the population. Also, I would like to stress that as I was mentioning to the part of the community a few days ago, that a monastery is a refuge for everybody. So that I understand that different people have their own political views and preferences, and that's natural. Some people might be very distressed and upset about the vote for the UK to leave the European Union. Other people might be feeling, at last, hooray, freedom from oppression from Brussels. At last we can climb out from under the Maastricht Agreement, and so on. But it's really important that the monastery is a refuge for everybody, that it's a completely non-partisan place. So this is not a left-wing monastery, a right-wing monastery. It's not a remaining monastery, and it's not an exiting monastery. It's not a green monastery or purple monastery. It's not a red-shirt monastery or a yellow-shirt monastery. It's a Buddhist monastery. It's a refuge for everyone. And that's one of the great strengths of a place like this, and a wonderful inheritance we have from the clarity of practice of Lumpur Cha, Lumpur Sumedho, that they are very, very resolute and clear in this kind of principle, so that recognizing it, people have their own perspectives. But it's a wonderful thing that you can have a staunch royalist, a real royal family-loving traditionalist, sitting next to someone who's a staunch Republican, kind of anti-royalist, and they're both chanting Yosop in tune with each other, next to each other, and bowing with equal respect to the Triple Gem. So whether you happen to favor the exit or the remain side, or you're confused about the whole thing, then the important thing is that those are your opinions, your feelings, but when we are talking with each other, when people come to visit the monastery, I would really encourage everyone who lives here in particular to take this sincerely to heart, that that your opinions and feelings are one thing, and the welcoming quality of the monastery is another. So that it's not to suppress or negate our feelings or our perspective. But even if you have very strong feelings that say the vote to leave the European Union was a huge mistake, and you can say, yeah, but Ajahn, they published a figure, 1.2 million people already who voted to leave already regret making that choice. It's they proved it. There's been a survey. It's true. It's a fact. So, well, it's not a matter of taking a fact and then bashing somebody over the head with it. But to say, well, this is a feeling I have. I feel very strongly about this. I feel in this way. Now, here is this good person who's just come in to the monastery, and they are very happy to be here, coming along to the meditation class, and they're wearing their Union Jack T-shirt, and they're extremely happy about the fact that the vote was to leave the European Union. So do you receive them as a Dhamma practitioner and someone who is looking for guidance in meditation, or do you lay your opinions upon them and get into an argument? So I would strongly encourage that you lay your opinions aside, and to not just see that person as an other, someone who's different, or someone who's on my side, who agrees with me, but to see that opinions arise and pass away. They're not the whole story. And part of our work in practicing Dhamma is not to typecast each other as women, as men, as lay people, as monastics, as Theravadins or Mahayanists or Buddhists or Christians or Muslims or Hindus. to not just see each other according to these labels, but rather to see beyond those labels and to say, well, yes, they have a certain relevance. Yeah, that you can say the person is a woman or a man. They can say they're a Christian or a Buddhist. But that's not the whole story. It never is the whole story. And when we are able to, say, put aside those judgments, then we're able to meet the whole being. We're not just identified with our own opinion, our own perspective, our own, say, our own role as a monastic or as a woman, as a man, as a layperson. We're not identified with that. We can put that aside, and then we meet others as human to human, one being meeting another being, and that's all. So I would really encourage maintaining the standard and making those choices moment by moment to sustain Amravati really as a deathless realm, a realm where the deathless, the Amata Dhamma, is embodied, and embodied in Supatipanno, Ujjipatipanno, Nyayapatipanno, Samichipatipanno, in practicing well, practicing directly, practicing insightfully, and practicing with integrity, with thoroughness and commitment. The balance between respecting our own feelings, our own perspectives, and meeting the perspectives and feelings of others moment by moment, it's a challenge to keep that balance. It's not easy. Having a bamboo cane balanced on the end of your finger. You've got to move carefully to keep the poles, you know, keep the stick standing upright. You know, you've got to move carefully because it's about to tilt over and fall very easily, all the time. But we can do it, and I would say not only is it a gift to those who come to visit, to the other guests and daily visitors, other members of the community, but it's a gift to yourself as well. It's a freeing of the heart from that kind of bias, from the distortions, the biases that are always causing us, I'd say, to be bound, to be limited, you know, the biases of greed, hatred, delusion, and fear, what are called the agati. These are the distortions, the habits, the kind of preferences of the mind. So that when we remember, oh, well, it's just my opinion, or well, the way I like to think is, or from my perspective, it's like this. The more that you can remember that, to remember that your perspective is just a perspective, your opinion is just an opinion, then it frees the heart from that bias. It's that perspective is still there. Like, I'm sitting in this position, I see the temple from this spot because I'm sitting up on the Dhamma seat right now. Yeah, this is my perspective, but it's not an absolute, it's not the only perspective. Those who are sitting opposite me are seeing a different picture of the temple, but it's the same temple. So that when we are able to recognize those opinions as such and keep them in context, then we can carry on in our ordinary life. We still perform the roles of being a monastic, being a layperson, being a visitor, being a teacher, being a student, whatever it might be. But there, those roles, those aspects of our nature are kept in perspective. They're not given more value, more substance than they really possess. So when we sustain this kind of perspective, then the heart is freed from the agati, from those biases of fear, greed, hatred, delusion, and that's the pathway to freedom, to the quality of independence, true independence. So the one of the phrases that the Buddha used in describing stream entry, one who has entered into the way of Dhamma, when the heart irrevocably attuned to the reality of its own nature, when the mind, the heart, is awakened to its own nature, then one of the phrases that the Buddha uses is to say that then the heart, that being, is independent of others in the teacher's training. They're independent of others. Doesn't matter what the Ajahn says or what the external sources say, you can trust your own insight. You're independent of others in the teacher's dispensation. That means you don't have to rely on the external authorities, but you know, you can trust your own insight. And that independence of others, that freedom, is based upon the freeing the heart from those biases, to know them and understand them for what they are. So essentially, as a practice that I describe very often, what is most helpful, particularly when the things are extremely turbulent, agitated, and the uncertainty factor is cranked up very high, anicca is turned up to 11 on the dial, is to be resolute in sustaining a mindfulness of mood, mindfulness of attitude. Because the more uncertain things are, the more the mind is prone towards leaping towards judgment. We don't like uncertainty, so we try to make things certain, and we make things certain, or we try to, by having opinions and judgments. It's like this, and we should do that, and this is right and that's wrong. We push against uncertainty by trying to create certainty, and we do that by forming judgments, opinions, and hanging on to them. And that's one way that we deal with uncertainty. The other end of the spectrum, the way that we deal with uncertainty, is just get completely lost in it. We just get caught in doubt and worry, and the mind endlessly creating stories. And what about this? And what if that happens? And if it goes this way, and then, what'll I do if? And the mind is completely lost in confusion and worry and anxiety. So those are the two of the extremes that the mind can move towards when faced with emotionally charged uncertainty, like a time of conflict and distress and increasing hate crimes and racial prejudice and national prejudice and so on. So that it becomes more and more important to develop that mindfulness of mood. So when the mind forms that kind of a fear. What's going to happen next? What'll I do? It's all falling apart. To be able to step back and say, this is the, what am I going to do? How's it going to be? It's all falling apart. Feeling. That's what this is. As they say, there's a very nice expression they have in the States, which is going to hell in a handbasket. That might be a little bit esoteric for the non-English speakers. A handbasket, like a little bag that you carry along. Like going to hell in a handbasket, which means everything is falling apart and it's a disaster. But if you like, as a, you might have that, it's all going to hell in a handbasket. Feeling. Or you might feel, the mind might go to sort of angry judgments, or like, how dare so-and-so, they set this whole thing in motion and then they bail out. How dare they? Who do they think they are? If I meet Boris on the street, I'm going to Well, that's the, if I meet Boris on the street, I'm gonna feeling. That's what that is. So this it takes a lot of care and diligence. But this is where the supatipanno, ujupatipanno, nyayapatipanno, samichipatipanno comes in. If we apply ourselves, bring the attention directly to each moment, and act in a way of integrity and unbiasedness, then we'll be able to catch those feelings as they form. We'll be able to catch those judgments or those confusions as they form. And then simply naming them for what they are, then that brings a certain amount of space around them. That in that recognition, oh, this is a feeling, this is an attitude, this is a doubt. That's what this is. It's a doubt. You're not trying to fill up the doubt with certainty. You're not trying to get rid of the doubt by coming up with a guaranteed correct answer. But you're recognizing this is the doubting feeling. That's what this is. And in that moment of recognizing this is a doubt, you know, this is a judgment, then that which knows it's a judgment, it's a doubt, it's a feeling, it's a mood, that is not, that which knows it is not caught in it. That which is aware that this is a doubt, this is a judgment, is not judging, is not doubting. It's free of that. So in that very gesture of naming it, knowing it, and clarifying what's going on, there's a degree of disentanglement. There's a degree of clarity. It's no longer that judgment is true. You know, he shouldn't have done that, or you know, she should be this way. Or it's recognized for what it is. You're not pretending it. You're not trying to make it other than it is. You're just recognizing this is a feeling, this is a judgment. Now, when I talk this way, which I often do, I always like to emphasize that this doesn't mean being passive. When you're looking at, say, a feeling of that's really bad, that the person shouldn't have done that, it doesn't mean therefore say nothing, therefore do nothing, therefore sit on your hands and let things be exactly as they are, because we're involved. We're part of the whole picture. We are the world as well as observing the world. We participate in life and in the world and in reality. We're part of it. So it's not a matter of that observing or knowing meaning passivity. It doesn't mean non-engagement, but rather it's a freeing the heart to engage. Engaging based on mindfulness and wisdom, engaging based on what's actually going to be useful, beneficial for yourself, for others, speaking in a way that's going to be true, it's going to be timely, it's going to be honest, going to be with loving kindness and compassion as the guiding forces, so that that quality of observing or spaciousness around a mood, around a thought, it frees the heart to act without bias. So it might be that what comes forth is, don't say anything, just be quiet. But it can also be rather when you let go and say, okay, this is a mood, this is a feeling, it can be that, well, I'd much rather not get involved, but I recognize that something needs to be said, and I guess it might as well be me that says it. So then you find that you can be more courageous and more selfless in your giving and your engagement because of having let go. If the mind is still hanging on or tied up, entangled with an opinion or a judgment view, then sometimes we hold back or we... our identification, our clinging on to that perspective causes us to, if we speak on it, we speak on it in a very aggressive way or a self-centered way, or we don't want to be angry, so we just sit on it and say nothing. But if there's mindfulness and wisdom, if there's that spaciousness around a mood, then we find that we're able to to speak up, take action, get involved, take appropriate steps to work, to campaign for something that you see is very worthwhile. But that engaging or campaigning or involvement does not cause more confusion and agitation because it's based on mindfulness and wisdom. Then the result of it is peacefulness. You do what you can, you contribute what you can, you do your best to help things go in a way that you see as being skillful and beneficial, and you let go of the result. And you do it the best you can and then leave it alone. So that quality of knowing feelings, knowing moods, then frees the heart to respond to those moods, those judgments, those perceptions, in a way that is in tune with Dhamma, in tune with reality. So I offer these thoughts for consideration, and if the misery of others is any consolation, that just consider that in America they've got Donald Trump. If that's any consolation, that there's my American half experiences involvement with the Donald Trump phenomenon. As part of life, as a prospect as well, so that's also to be considered. So, anyone.